This is Kelly Greger conducting an oral history interview with Mr. Richard Bustamante. Today is 25 January 2017. I am in Lubbock, Texas on the campus of Texas Tech University. Mr. Bustamante is joining me by telephone from his home in McKinney, Texas. Okay, Richard, to begin this interview, I'd like to get some background and biographical information from you. Can you tell me when and where you were born?
Yeah, I was born in San Jose, California. And my mother tells me that I was born during a blackout. So I was born in during World War II in 1942.
Oh, okay. That's just the first of the year in 1942, correct?
Yeah, I don't know if that's a good thing in a blackout or not, but that's what you told me.
Well, you made it out anyway, so you're in good shape, I guess. What were your parents' names?
My mother's name was Mary Jean, and my father's name was Richard, the same as mine.
Okay. What did they do for a living there?
Well, at the end, and my father was in the war. He was in he was a corpsman in the Navy during World War II in the Pacific. And, of course, my mother was a homemaker. But when he was finished, he was working in the electronic field. Televisions, I think sales and service.
Okay. And what about your mother?
Mother didn't work.
Did you have any brothers or sisters?
I had one sister, mm-hmm. and no brothers.
All right. Did you grow up there in California?
No, my parents were divorced when I was younger, around 9 years, 8 years old. And so she remarried a gentleman from Michigan. So I wound up in Detroit for, I guess, 9 years, 18 when I left Detroit to join the military.
Well, tell me what life was like growing up, both on the West Coast and there in Detroit.
I thought California was a lot of fun. I mean, we had a great time. I had friends in the neighborhood. And I can't, you know, you don't remember everything, but I do remember three or four of the friends that we all ran around. We played ball. We had a good time. When we moved to Michigan, it was a sort of a culture shock because I wasn't used to snow and ice. But I learned quickly that it's a lot of fun. And I had a lot of friends that I still do that live in Michigan, high school friends and others, and I enjoyed Michigan a lot. I learned to fish more there, which is a passion of mine, fishing and playing golf. Michigan has tons of lakes, so it's a fun place to go, and it's a fun place to fish.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that your parents had divorced when you were pretty young. Were you able to spend much time with your father? Did he talk to you about his experiences in the Second World War?
No. When my parents divorced, it must have been nasty because, you know, a little guy like me, I don't remember stuff like that when I was 9 years old. But she moved to Michigan and remarried, and I didn't hear from my dad until I decided to join the Navy because my grandfather and my great-grandfather were all in the Navy, and I said, well, I'm going to keep the tradition going. I was given an option when I joined to go to boot camp in the Great Lakes or in San Diego, and I chose San Diego for two reasons. One, I didn't want to be in the Great Lakes in cold weather, and two, if I was in San Diego, I might have an opportunity to go find my dad and look him up and see how he was or what was going on. So that was two of the reasons why I chose the San Diego boot camp as opposed to the Great Lakes.
Sure.
Unfortunately, the San Diego is now closed and the only basic training place for military, for the Navy anyway, is in Great Lakes, which is in Illinois.
Right. You mentioned wanting to join the Navy because of family tradition, largely. I wonder, were you aware of larger global events? The Cold War is raging here. What were you aware of in terms of the United States and its position in the world at that time?
Everybody's aware of it at the time that I was going to school, grade school and high school, because you always had these air raid drills, so you knew that things weren't exactly the way you'd like to have them. And you knew that there was possibility of wars and there's possibilities of nuclear attacks and those sort of things. And so you always understood what was going on. The Cold War was a big issue because we understood that that we were at odds with a large country, Russia, and there seemed to be going back and forth between the two countries all the time. So I think growing up in that area, you were always aware of the potential of a war, or potential of a nuclear attack. And my reason for joining the military was, you know, twofold, like I mentioned before. And there was another reason. I was tired of school. I didn't want any more school.
I see.
I could have gone to college, but I didn't want to go to college. I did go to college after the Navy and get my degree, but I didn't really care about school. I guess the way to say it is, sometimes it was boring for me.
Mm-hmm.
So I joined the Navy, and that was a good thing for me. It might not be good for others, but for me, it was a good thing.
Sure. And when did you join the Navy?
I joined it in almost late 1960.
Okay, in late 1960. All right. So this kind of begs the question, and we'll get into the Navy part here in just a little bit, but in 1960, of course, November 60, the election, Kennedy versus Nixon, and the incoming president was somewhat different from what America had seen in the past. What are your recollections on Kennedy, and what did his presidency mean to you?
You know, my recollections were, we were really happy. Most of us that I knew were very happy and pleased that there was an ex-military guy, an ex-Navy, what made us even happier. And two, that he was a younger person as opposed to an older person. At that time, I think everybody I knew was pretty happy about it. I'm sure there were plenty of people that weren't, but the ones I knew were very comfortable with Kennedy being president.
Yeah.
And we're looking forward to him doing good things.
Tell me about your time at San Diego, in boot camp in San Diego. What was that like for you? What was the routine?
It's interesting. You know, you're a young kid, you go there and you're fresh, you don't know what to expect, and the first thing they do is wake you up at 0:30 in the morning, drag you out, and send you over to breakfast, and then they start processing you, and the first thing they want to do is cut all your hair off. The second thing they want to do is you go through a line and they give you a bunch of clothes. They kind of guess at what your size is, and you get a bunch of clothes. And then the next thing you do is you wind up going to a barracks where you're going to be housed, and you're assigned to a drill instructor, and a drill instructor starts off by telling you you need to take everything out of your bag. It's a sea bag. That's what the Navy uses. You take everything out of your sea bag and lay it on the ground. You've got a stencil, and you've got a marking pen, felt tip, that you got when you went through gathering up your clothes. You're going to sit down, and I'm going to show you how to stencil every one of your clothes, and you have to do every one of them exactly the way I showed you. So that was interesting. Then the next thing, you know, you start marching a little bit and learning how to drill. And the second or third day, you know, you need to wash your clothes, so you learn how to scrub your own clothes on this big cement slab behind your barracks. And then they tell you that you need to tie your clothes on a drying line with a square knot. So you get up there, and if you don't know how to tie a square knot, the drill instructor will come by and he'll see that you didn't put your clothes on a square knot. He'll take the clothes off the line, throw them on the ground, and everybody gets to march back and forth over them two or three times, and then you get to wash them over. So, you know, you learn those kinds of things. And boot camp is just like most other boot camps. It's marching, learning the military way. And in the Navy, there are some education classes as well about ship handling, what to do on a ship, what you're supposed to do and not supposed to do. And they have a mock-up ship that's kind of like a destroyer escort. And they call it the USS Recruit. So you go on there and you get to climb. climb up and down and walk around and that sort of stuff and learn a little bit about the Navy. Then further on in the session, you'll learn about a lot of different things that you need to learn when you're on a ship, mostly a lot about knots, about what to do and what not to do. Then you get to visit ships in the harbor in San Diego. We visited the USS Dixie, which was a destroyer tender. A destroyer tender is a supply ship that has parts that can be used to repair destroyers. There are submarine tenders, destroyer tenders, and so we visited that on a particular day, and we walked through the quarters and saw the bunks and saw where they ate and that sort of stuff, went up to the bridge and the engine room. So you got to see everything that you would see on a normal ship. Another time, we were taken aboard a submarine because they wanted us to understand what sub-duty was about. And so you got to go on a submarine. It didn't go to sea. You just walked around, you looked at everything. And the sailors that were on the submarine were very nice. They told you about different stuff and what they did and what they didn't do. Then as part of your training, you go through a number of sessions of testing. And through the testing, they determine where you would best fit in the Navy. In my particular case, it was in electronics, and they put me into radar. So I wound up going to school in San Francisco at Treasure Island. It's 18 weeks of electronic training to learn about radars, how to repair them, take care of them. And then another 8 weeks of operational, so you learn how to manage and operate the Combat Information Center in the warships where you keep track of targets and so forth. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of what my first year was about.
Yeah. Well, I wonder if you could tell me about this radar and technical school, this training that you're going to receive. What was the curriculum like? What was the pace of life like? Take me through that time in that level of training.
Okay, you when you're finished with boot camp, of course you have leave. You get to go home or go where you want. And when I took my leave, that's when I went and looked for my father and found him. And so we had a nice reunion, and I started visiting him more often when I had time. You went up to Treasure Island, which is outside of San Francisco, between Oakland and San Francisco. It's a little island out there, just like, it's kind of like Alcatraz, but it's got the bridge to it. Alcatraz didn't. So
right.
The island there is housed two different types of schools. It had electronic schools for electronic technicians, ETs, and it had radar school for radarmen and radarmen technicians. And the training consisted of basic electronics, and it went from basic electronics to radar theory, radar applications, how a radar works, what the components of the radar transmitter are, what the components of the antennas were, what types of antennas, what kind of waveguides were used to feed the antenna, the transmissions, and then from that on, if you went to radar school, you wound up going into operations where you learned how to use the radar repeaters, track targets, you understood how to do navigation, and then you learned how to provide information on these big plastic boards that you see sometimes in these movies. You see guys that are in combat, that they call Combat Information Center, the abbreviation is combat, and you'll see people writing backwards on these boards, so that people can see them. So you learn how to do all of that stuff. You do dead reckoning tracking. You learn how to do all sorts of stuff, communications, talking on radio telephones, talking to other ships. That was part of the operational phase of the radar school. Once you're finished with the the electronics, and then the radar operational phase, then you get assigned to a ship. In my case, I was assigned to the USS Richard B. Anderson destroyer DD-786, and I was transferred to Bremerton, Washington, where the ship was in dry dock being converted from a Gehring-class World War II destroyer to a Gehring-class Fram II destroyer.
Mm-hmm.
The Fram II conversion added a better bridge, an enclosed bridge. It added an ASRock launcher, and it added sophisticated electronics, both radar and electronic countermeasures equipment. The third thing that it did is it changed the tail of the ship, fantail, from a twin mount 55-inch mount gun to a hangar with a deck and a drone helicopter used to fight submarines. So the ship was basically made for two purposes. One, it was an anti-submarine ship, and it was also an electronics intelligence ship.
Mm-hmm. And when did you go aboard the Richard B. Anderson?
In 61.
Okay, so it's still in 1961 then. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, let me...
Late 61.
Great. Let me ask you this then, because it kind of goes back to the Kennedy thing we talked about earlier. Of course, early in 61, we've got the Bay of Pigs and everything that ensued there. Did you hear about this while you were going through training?
Yes, we all heard about that.
Yeah.
And when we were on the ship, as a matter of fact, when the ship in... when we picked it up in Bremerton, it was finished. Maybe 2 months before it was completely finished, and then we were on sea trials. But after sea trials, we were in the Puget Sound, and then we're out at the Pacific, and we picked up a Russian submarine and tracked it down to the Panama Canal. That was about the time that all of the stuff was happening over in Cuba with the missiles and all that sort of stuff. So it's sort of an interesting deal with the Cold War.
Yeah.
And everybody was very supportive on the ship. Everybody very supportive of the president. And for the most part, that's the way military is. We're not, in the military, you're not political. You do what your duty asks you to do. And you don't really think about, okay, well, this is the president, do I like him or not? No, he's your president, you do what he asks you to do.
Right. That's really interesting. How did you take to the schooling and the training, and now that you're on board the Anderson, what did you think about your choice of the Navy and choice of this career path in the Navy?
I thought it was really correct for me. I was really good with math in school. And I had also built some radios, crystal radios, and some ham equipment that I would like a lot that friends of mine had. And so that was an interest of mine. So the electronics part matched up with my math really well. And so I was very pleased. I said, you know, this I could have been doing a lot of things, but I think this was one that I really liked. And being aboard a ship that was the latest and greatest in the technology even made it more interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So I felt like I made the right choice at the right time, and it was a good choice for me.
Yeah. Okay, you're out of Bremerton. You mentioned Puget Sound. Take me on the first not really a shakedown, I guess, but after it's been refitted. Take me on this cruise.
Yeah.
What sort of things do you do on a cruise like this?
Well, on my first cruise, it was not pleasant for me. Many times when you're the new person on the ship, that you wind up with kitchen duty and KP.
Mm-hmm.
In my particular case, I was what was called a spud coxswain. Now, a coxswain in the Navy is someone that drives a boat, the captain's boat or a different boat, any of the little work boats, they're coxswains. A spud coxswain is someone that peels potatoes. So I was a spud coxswain when we went to sea. And so where you do that that work, you're down in the galley, over by where it's called the scullery, where it's where they wash the dishes and stuff after the troops and the crew's eaten. And you're peeling potatoes and throwing them in the peelings out and throwing the good ones in a bucket. And all of a sudden, you're at sea, you're through the Puget Sound and you're at sea, and the ship's rocking and rolling and you've never been at sea before. Well, I thought I was going to die. So I wound up going up to the sick bay and talking to we don't have doctors, we have corpsmen on destroyers. And I talked to the corpsman, who was a chief petty officer, and he said, yeah, I've seen this. What you need is to take these three little pills and then go lay down in your bunk. So I took those little pills, I went and laid down in my bunk, and a day later I woke up back in port. So that was my first experience at sea duty. From then on, even in the two typhoons we were in the South China Sea, I never got sick again.
Hmm.
But my first time out, it was pretty rough.
Yeah, it sounds like it.
Oh, it was. I thought I was going to die.
Did anybody give you any trouble for this?
Oh, you always get ragged when you get seasick. I mean, we had one guy who always had a packet or two or three of saltine crackers in his pocket and a coffee can in his hand. And as soon as you set the sea and anchor detail getting ready to go to sea, he was seasick. Now, for whatever reason, his name was Snooker, he's a good guy. For whatever reason, he shipped over for 6 years to go to our Radar B school. I was in Radar A school, to go to B school and then stay in the Navy. And I kept thinking to him and talking to him, I said, Sinker, why are you doing that, man? You get seasick as soon as the ship takes a line off your rock and you're sick. He said, I just like the Navy. I said, okay. I said, you know, that's a radarman's steady diet of sea duty. They don't, you know, there's not much shore duty for radarmen.
Yeah.
He said, yeah, I know, but I like it. I said, okay. So that, you know, it was interesting for me to get ragged on, but then to see a guy like him that was already rated, which means you were a petty officer. That's calling getting rated. So he was already a petty officer. I think he was second class, and he was going to go to peace school. I was just a seaman, but I had the radar skill, so I was a radarman seaman on the ship. So that's kind of the first couple of weeks or month on the ship. It was really interesting. And then we were moved to San Diego. That was our home port. So we went down to San Diego, and of course you get to go out to sea a lot when you're on a destroyer. And what I remember was in the last two or three years I was in the Navy that I had spent more time at sea than I had on shore.
Hmm.
And so I said, you know, that's a steady diet of out to sea if you're a radarman, especially on a warship. But I enjoyed the time I was in, and I would have done it again if I had to do it over.
Yeah.
And it's true, we have reunions every year with a number of the men that were on, sailors and crew members that were on the ship, some during the time I was on, you know, quite a few of them. Half a dozen, and then guys that were on at different times. And what holds true is that the sailor is never out of the sea. He always remembers the sea, and there's a love with the ship that never dies. Everybody that I know that was on that ship when I was on it absolutely loved the ship. And we do a lot of stuff in the reunion, four other members, and to try and remember the ship. As a matter of fact, the ship was named after a World War II Medal of Honor winner, Richard B. Anderson, who was in a foxhole with a number of Marines, and I guess one of the Japs threw a hand grenade in there. He covered the hand grenade with his body. Of course, he was killed, but he saved all of his Marines in there with him. So the destroyers typically were named after Medal of Honor winners or people that are recognized with awards. To give a little history in the Navy while I'm digressing from things, but I'll get back to where you and I were talking.
No, that's fine.
Typically, aircraft carriers were named after battles or wars. Battleships are named after states. Destroyers are all named, like I mentioned, and cruisers are named after cities. And submarines were named after fish. So that's all been changed, you know, lately. But that's the original way during World War II and World War I, ships were named. So anyway, that's kind of digressed a little bit, but. The radar school, the ship was great. I loved it. You always complain, and they say a bitchin' sailor is not a happy sailor. If he's not complaining about something, then he's not happy.
You'd mentioned missiles in Cuba. Cuban Missile Crisis there in October of 1962. What was your role? What did you hear? What were you doing aboard the Anderson?
Well, we had picked up that Russian submarine, and we were tracking him. And so I was a radarman, so I was in Combat Information Center. And I was on watch doing radar duty, or I was doing ECM duty. And the sonarmen that were tracking the sub, they call it Sonar Shack, but their facility was attached to where our facility was. So the Combat Information Center was a big square on the ship up on the upper deck, and right behind us, with just a little sliding door, was the sonar shack with the sonar equipment. So we were heavily involved in tracking the submarine on our charts and our dead reckoning tables, while the sonarmen were tracking it as well. They're giving us information about, you know, okay, we're heading 180, which means doing dead south, so we're tracking it. Every time they make a move, we track the move, and we record it on our charts. So we were heavily involved, even though the sonarmen are the guys that are tracking the submarine, because he's underwater and our equipment is all above water. It was interesting. The interesting part was when the captain of the Russian submarine decided he had enough fun. He was gone in a blink.
Is that right?
Oh, yeah. You know, 1 minute they sonar guys had him, the next minute he was gone. We never saw him again.
Most likely knew that, obviously, that you were tracking.
Oh, he knew it. Yeah. Well, once you fired off the sonar, because of the sound, you know, he's listening to it. He's hearing it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure his sonar operators are listening to us as well.
Right.
And so, you know, you hear the sound of the sonar wave as it goes out. You can hear it on the ship, you can hear it underwater.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, bring me back from the Panama Canal. What happens next on the Anderson?
Next, we were just mostly hanging around in San Diego, and then we were shipped out to the Hawaiian Islands. We called it the Pineapple Fleet. And so we were shipped out there for a few months to go through an operation wound up in Christmas Islands. But first, the couple of months or so, we were out there training, getting ready for the nuclear test in Christmas Islands. We were having a good time in Hawaii. The weather was great, and everybody had a lot of fun.
What sort of things were you guys doing?
Well, we were going to luau's and surfing and, you know, doing all the kind of stuff that sailors do, trying to have as much fun as possible without getting in trouble. So some guys got in trouble, but most of us didn't. And it was a lot of fun. One thing that I do remember that was really interesting is that we took off 1 week on the ship. We just went out of port by ourselves. And I said, oh, we're going out to sea duty. And we wound up going to the island of Kauai.
Hmm.
And we pulled into a port in Kauai. And we were the first warship that had ever been there since World War II. And the port was named Na Willy Willy. So we pulled into the port of Na Willy Willy. And at the end of the pier was a nightclub. And so everybody's clamoring to get off the ship to go down to the nightclub and have a good time. What we didn't realize was there was a star down at the nightclub that none of us knew about. And so we all hovered down in the nightclub pretty quick. And Tempest Storm was at the nightclub doing a strip show.
Oh, is that right?
So, you know, you got a lot of sailors that have been out to sea. The first thing they see is they see Tempest Storm pulling off some clothes. They're hooting and hollering and having a big time. So it was sort of interesting. And then we spent the rest of the time, I think we spent a week there, touring the island, you know, having a lot of fun. It was really nice. And the people were very nice to us.
You mentioned nuclear tests at Christmas Island. Can you tell me what this was all about? When did it take place and what was going on there?
I think it was in 62, I recall. The destroyer I was on and our sister ships had what was called ASROC, anti-submarine rockets, which were nuclear-tipped torpedoes with a rocket booster. And those things had been tested some, but they wanted to do a real test. So our sister ship and ourselves, we went down from Hawaii, Pearl Harbor, to the Christmas Islands, and the Navy had an old World War II submarine that they had put at a certain depth, and our sister ship and I, ours, went towards the ship to fire off one of these nuclear-tipped torpedoes and blow up the submarines. They wanted to see how that was going to work. And as part of that, each of the destroyers, mine and Agerholm, that's a sister ship, had people from what we call them yardbirds. They were people that were civilians that were going to be on board monitoring the explosion, what happened after the explosion, and taking pictures and stuff of everything that occurred. For a day or two while we were out there getting ready for the explosion, these civilians were up mounting cameras on the flag deck, which is above the bridge, and on other locations on a ship, mounting cameras so they can take pictures of what happened and what occurred after the explosion. All of us were given dosimeters to wear. And we got them, we call them pocket dosimeters. They just flipped onto your pocket. So we had the nuclear test. Of course, everybody goes to battle stations when they do that. And didn't seem much happening. Then we could look on the radar, and we could see a disturbance in the water. And the guys on the bridge were telling us that here comes a shock wave, and it was a small tidal wave. And it was maybe 3 or 4 foot high. And, of course, it came pretty quick. And it hit the ship, knocked it over, knocked us around a little bit, and knocked all the cameras off the places where these civilians had placed them. So we all got a pretty good laugh about that. Said, oh, here they go, come out here spending all this money on cameras. And the first time a big wave hits it, it knocked them all down. So that was the test. It was successful, and it proved that the anti-submarine rocket performed as expected. And so the other things that we did was we used the drone helicopter on the ship to, it was equipped to carry a torpedo.
Yeah, tell me about that. That's interesting.
Yeah, the drone helicopter was equipped to carry a torpedo. And what it would do is once you had a radar sonar contact, it would give you bearing and distance. Approximate distance, but bearing, and depending on the sound of the echo, the return of the echo, you could tell whether how far or approximately how far it was. And so the drone would go out there, and when you were over the target, it would drop a torpedo, and that was used to kill the sub. We never did that, but that's what the use of it was. We did test the drone, sending it out and testing it. And the first time we sent one out to check on it, it never came back, so that was sort of a funny deal there. Guys had to fix that pretty quick when they found out it didn't work. So the people that manufactured that found the problem and came back and gave us another one and fixed it.
Hmm. So nuclear test, I mean, that's pretty big medicine for a young guy, young radar man out there in the Pacific. That must have been pretty cool.
It was. I was rated by then. I was third class, so I thought I was leading the watch up there then. So it was kind of fun for me. You didn't know what to expect, but you did enjoy the fact that it was successful and it proved that what you had aboard your ship to prevent submarines from attacking the rest of the fleet really worked, and you could go after them and pick them up and knock them down if you needed to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, what's next for you and the Anderson after these tests?
Well, after that, we're back in San Diego for a while, and then we're dispatched to the 7th Fleet, which is the Pacific, West Pacific, so they call them Westpac cruises.
Mm-hmm.
So we were off to the South China Sea and Westpac. And, of course, on the way, you stop a few places. We stopped at the Philippines at Longapo, Subic Bay, and that was sort of interesting because that's sort of a different kind of place.
Can you tell me about your time there in the Philippines? It was, obviously this is too far from
it. Yeah, Philippines was interesting. We had a bunch of Filipinos on our ship. Most of them were stewards and a couple of them were cooks. And they were excited and they said, come with me, I'll take you to the right place, we won't get in trouble. And so they were pretty nice guys. I liked them a lot and I had a couple of good friends that were Filipinos. Subic Bay and Longapo was kind of different. Any sailor that's been there will tell you it's all drinking and women. That's all that's there. One of the other things that we were able to do is there's an island called Grande Island, and we had a ship's picnic there, which was really a lot of fun because you could go scuba diving, and it was very pretty and very nice, and a lot of us did that. But Longapo is a pretty tough place. After Longapo, we went to Okinawa, and we pulled into Okinawa Christmas Eve, and I was assigned shore patrol on Christmas Eve. That would have been 62, 63. And we got in late, and so when I got to shore patrol headquarters, they told me that everything was taken, and I was going to be assigned to the riot squad.
Hmm.
And I told them, I said, look, guys, I'm 5'8", I weigh 150 pounds, period. I don't think I'm good at the riot squad. I said, no, I'm sorry, you're stuck. You're going to be on the riot squad. So I said, is there anybody else on the riot squad? I said, well, there's a couple of guys over there on it. I looked over there, and there was this one Marine sergeant, about 6'2". I said, I walked over and I said, you got a partner yet? He said, nope. I said, no, you got one now. So he and I became partners. And we got to be friends. And no longer had we been talking and getting to be friends. Then we got a call that we needed to go to, they called them villages when we were there, village 1, 2, and 3. I'm sure they had names, but I didn't know the names. We just know by numbers. There's a riot fighting in the village number 2. A bunch of sailors and Marines are on the street fighting. So here we go. We jump in the Jeep and drive up there. And we get there, and they're pretty heavily into it. And he looked at me, and I looked at him, and I said, no, I'm not going to get in the middle of that. He said, I'm not either. Let's just blow the whistles, break it up, and whatever we find that needs some help, we'll take them to the hospital. I said, that works for me. That's what we did. We just blew the whistles, got them all quieted down, took ones that were hurt back to the hospital, and and then look for us and go, we weren't about to arrest people. We didn't know who started it, why it was started. Just Marines and sailors getting drunk and fighting.
Right.
That's pretty much the way it was.
Yeah, no big surprise there.
No big surprise.
Yeah. So that's Christmas in Okinawa in 1962.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool. How long did this Westpac cruise last?
They last 9 months. Sometimes a little longer, sometimes shorter. But mm-hmm. usually 9-10 months. They're supposed to be half a year, 6 months, but they're never 6 months. Sometimes they're a little longer, sometimes they're less. I think ours was around 8 months.
Okay.
And during that cruise, that's when we visited Japan a number of times, so, a lot of different cities. We went to Yokosuka, we went to Sasebo, we went to Kobe, we went to Kiri, and we went to Hong Kong, all at different times. But you're doing different things in Westpac. A lot of times you're just doing what's called plane guarding, which is sitting by an aircraft carrier in case an aircraft has to ditch so that you can go and pick them up. That's what's called plane guard duty, and you're usually, I don't know, 1,000 yards, maybe behind the aircraft carrier, maybe 2,000 yards. And maybe 2,000 yards a mile. So usually you're a little closer than a mile, so you can get up quick and do stuff if you need to. And destroyers are taught in the operational phase of their training to develop intercept patterns. For instance, if the destroyer senses a torpedo is being shot at an aircraft carrier or a larger ship, we have intercept tracks that we use to intercept the torpedo. The destroyer is supposed to take the torpedo or anything else, aircraft, missile. That's the job of the destroyer, to protect the larger ship. So if we sense that, then we do intercepts and let the rocket or the torpedo or the missile hit us as opposed to the larger ship.
Hmm.
So everybody's trained that way and knows that we're expendable, and that's what we do.
Do you come back to San Diego after this, or do you stay there throughout the rest of through 63 and 64?
Well, after your 8 or 9 months, you come back to San Diego, and then you go back again.
Okay.
But in that 63 cruise, 62, 63 cruise, that's when we did a lot of event work.
You know, we're at the point in the interview where we probably better stop and take a break because of the schedule.
Sure.
But we'll pick up with this next time.
That'll be fine. Okay.
This is Kelly Kreger continuing an oral history interview with Mr. Richard Bustamante. Today is 2 February 2017. I'm in Lubbock, Texas, on the campus of Texas Tech University. Mr. Bustamante is joining me by telephone again from his home in McKinney, Texas. Okay, Richard. You mentioned off the recorder that you wanted to talk a little bit more about the Richard B. Anderson, about the ship, and you mentioned a little bit about that with the reunions and the association last time, but go ahead and talk to me about the Anderson.
The Anderson was a Garing-class destroyer built in World War II. It didn't see a lot of action during World War II, but one of the interesting things about the Anderson, there's a movie called The Caine Mutiny.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of people have seen.
Sure.
At the end of the movie, that Lieutenant J.G. was a ensign on the Caine, but became Lieutenant J.G. and got on a destroyer. That destroyer is the Anderson.
Hmm.
That's what it looked like before the Fram conversion. It had twin mounts up front and one in the back. After the conversion, the rear mount was replaced with a hangar and an ECM tower, electronic countermeasures tower. The middle of the ship was replaced, the torpedo racks and the gun racks were replaced with an ASROC launcher system, which is a nuclear tip torpedo. And then it did have torpedo tubes on each side, just three on each side of the ship. The interesting thing was the Anderson was completely fitted with the latest and greatest electronics, and it included radar, sonar, ELAN equipment, navigational equipment, and radio equipment. So when it set to sea, it was fully loaded with everything that you could think of as the newest and the best electronic equipment available. That being said, we did a lot of testing of the equipment and a lot of work with it. I was responsible for maintaining the ECM equipment, and it was called an ANWLR-1 unit, and it had various bands of frequency that you could go up and down and look for signals. And it also had storage capacity so that if you found a signal you wanted to look at, you could store it and then return to it by just pushing the button. Additionally, it had a monitor screen, which was significantly smaller than today's screens. It was maybe 6 inches diagonally. And it was used to view the electronic emission, whether it was radar or whatever you were looking at. And it gave you particular information about that signal. What happened when we went to San Diego was that there was a lot of testing going on of all the ships that had similar or older ECM equipment. And being responsible for the equipment, I managed to learn a lot about it and pass that on to three or four of my other shipmates, and we became a team that used the equipment. And we were lucky enough that we won all the contests on the ECM equipment. So we were pretty proud of that. The guys were really good guys, and they're good buddies. We still see each other. So we go from there about the equipment so that we know that the ship is fully loaded with the latest and greatest electronics, and then we go overseas. You asked a couple questions about Captain Titty, who was the full commander on the ship. He was what I call a captain. His uniforms were always pressed and creased and looked good. He was always neatly dressed. He never got upset, never got crazy about stuff. He was always straightforward. You knew what you expect when you were around him. And he was always friendly, and he was the kind of guy that the troops loved. The ships just were crazy about the kid. And they still are. He comes to some of the reunions when he's able. He hasn't been in a few because of some illnesses in the family and so forth. But when he was, he did come as often as he could. When we were over in Westpac, I think this was in 62 or 63, late, yeah, 62, 63, we got to Okinawa as we drifted on the way over there at Christmas time. And what I remember was we brought a bunch of Okinawan children, and those were Japanese children, on the ship for a Christmas party. And Captain Ted was taking care of all the kids, walking them around, showing them. And I said, man, there's a good guy right there. From Okinawa, we drifted around to Japan a few times, a number of locations, Yokosuka, Sasebo, Kobe, Curie, and over to the Philippines. When we went on ELAN patrols, we were on the Formosa Straits in the South China Sea. And I'm going to give you some background on radar. The radars have various frequencies for different types of radars. They have different pulse widths for different types of radars. They have a different bandwidth, pulse repetition rate, antenna rotation rate, and signal configuration. So as we were doing the ELAN work, we had set up a tape recording system so that we could record the radar sounds. We had a camera that we attached to the monitor and the ECM equipment so we could take pictures of the signals. we had a method where we identified each signal with a particular number. We then gave the relative bearing of the contact of the signal to guys out there in the ECM, in Combat Information Center, which is where the ECM equipment was housed in a separate little unit. And we'd give them bearings and potential ranges, because the signal strength will tell you whether it was long, long way away, or pretty close. And they would then use that and draw the relative bearing from the ship's track to land. And we would do that two or three times and triangulate every one of those contacts so we could kind of pinpoint where they were at on land. And we would do that for, you know, a week, 2 weeks, up and down the coast. The way you could identify a long-range radar would be the frequency would be lower, the pulse width would be wide, the pulse repetition rate would be medium, the antenna rotation rate would be fairly quick, and that's usually telling you that the antenna is in a 360 circular motion. So it's not
okay.
Sector scanning.
Which right.
Some radars do sector scans, some do 360 scans. And then the higher the frequency, the more definite, the different types of radars. For instance, the long-range air search radars are low frequencies. The medium-range search radars are a little higher frequency, shorter bandwidth. Then you go up the scale to the fire control radars, which are high frequency, and they use typically a sector scan to a conical scan. And when the fire control radar is locked on, it goes to a direct high-pitched scream. You can hear it in the earphones. And so that's how you could tell what kind of radar you were looking at. The other thing is the radars used on submarines were up in the same band of frequencies as the fire control radar. They were high frequency, short signal, and they usually use sector scans so that you had to get them pretty quick or you'd lose them fast. So that's pretty much what we did. We'd go up and down the coast. We'd map every one of these radar sites. Sometimes you didn't know there could be missile sites. And we'd map them. We'd take pictures of them. We'd record them. And many times I would make commentary, and so would my other shipmates when they were on watch, about different things. For instance, this was one time I looked at one. I said, boy, this is the most unusual one I've seen in a long time. So I took extra pictures, took extra recording, and we took extra bearings so that we could get a really good fix on it. All of that information is turned into a place called the PACOM ELINT Center, which is Pacific Command Electronics Intelligence Center. What those guys do is, and it's in Fuji, Japan, or it was, what they do up there is they take everything that we do, we give them, and everything they get from anybody else. And that gives them a pretty good idea of where all the radar sites are at that point in time, where all the missile sites are at, and any other kinds of information they can gather from the signals. And that's kind of what we did quite a bit of.
Really helping to draw a picture of what these radar sites were looking like there on the land.
Yeah, what you did is you now they knew what frequency the sites were on. They knew what the bandwidth were, the pulse repetition rates, the antenna rotation rates, the signal types, and that's a lot of information.
Yeah.
That they use to determine what was there and what it was used for.
Sure, and probably combined with I guess photo recon or human intelligence or wherever else these strands of information would come from to be able to get a more accurate picture of what they had going there, I guess.
Yeah, you know, you're talking about the coast of China down to the South China Sea, so you're getting what you really want, because that's a lot of information.
Yeah.
Yeah, from there we'd just go back to our primary function. A destroyer's primary function is to guard larger ships. There's a movie called Okinawa, which is about the invasion of Okinawa, the island. And it talks about how the destroyers were on picket in a circle around the island and around the ships, so that any enemy coming in towards the larger ships could be taken out by the destroyers on picket. Unfortunately, many destroyers were sunk because of kamikaze planes and that sort of stuff. But a destroyer function is to be picket duty, which is out way ahead of the fleet, the aircraft carriers, or the other larger ships, usually not battleships, because we didn't have many when I was in, but a lot of cruisers. And so you're out in front of them doing picket duty, which is you're looking ahead 50 to 100 miles ahead of where you are, which is probably 50 miles ahead of where you are from the larger ship, which means you're about 200, they're getting about 200 miles of information ahead of them, so that everybody knows what's going on. The other duty destroyers typically perform are behind the aircraft carriers and sitting there watching behind the carrier in the event of an accident to pick up survivors or that sort of stuff. They call that plane guard duty. I did see one aircraft come back that wasn't going to make it to the carrier, and instead of crashing into the fantail of the carrier, the aircraft went in the water, and we never found him or anything else. We did have one time when a aircraft was on fire above us, and the two members in the aircraft, the pilot, I guess a co-pilot or a radar operator, they bailed out, and we did not pick them up. We picked up someone another time, but we didn't pick those two guys up. Someone else got them. But that's kind of what you do, radar picket ships, and then you sit back in plane guard duty, or you go on ELAC patrols if you have the equipment.
I see. Now, this takes you through, 63 into 64, is that right?
Yep.
Okay. Let me pull back a little bit from the Anderson and ask you a question about what's going on in Southeast Asia. American presence there is increasing. There is American air bases there. We've got increasing national attention being paid to Southeast Asia, and particularly Vietnam, as opposed to primarily Laos like it was before, prior to this. What did you know about what was going on there? Anything?
Well, we all knew what was going on. I mean, you hear the news, plus you get information from other guys that just came back from overseas or Westpac. And so everybody knew kind of what was going on. When we were in Okinawa, I spent some time with some Marines in Okinawa, because one of the Lance Corporals over there, and I don't know what the name of the barracks were that they were on. He and I grew up together. We were lifelong friends, and so I spent some time with him while we were there at Okinawa. We were only there a couple of days, but we went to dinner and we went and had a few drinks and enjoyed each other's company. And when he and I talked, he said, "What are you guys?" I said, "What are you guys doing?" He said, "We're getting ready to go to some place we never heard of." And I said, "What was the name?" I said, "It's Vietnam. We're just going to kind of go over there to help out. We're not doing any fighting. We're just going to do get stuff set up." And he wound up being a cook, so I didn't think he was in any combat. But they were getting ready to go over, so we knew there was something going on when we talked with some of the Marines and some of the other guys that had just gotten back. And of course, we knew something was going on when we were over there, because we could hear, you could hear the news and stuff. But it wasn't going on as strong as it was later on. And it was just the beginning. But you heard a lot of stuff. So
What sort of stuff would you hear, Richard?
Well, you hear like, oh yeah, we're going over there. We don't know what's going on over there, but we're going to go over there and set up some camps or set up this or that. And then I did meet a couple of Green Berets a couple of times, and we made a couple of I met a couple of Marine. They're not, I forgot what they call themselves. They're like pathfinders. They were going out and doing some research, seeing what was going on, and getting ready for some sort of commitment. They never talked about what, but, you know, you knew something was happening.
Mm-hmm. Did you get any sort of news from the American
sources? Well, you know,
sources?
There was a couple of radio. We used to call her Beeping Polly. That's like Tokyo Rose.
Mm-hmm.
And you could hear her on each game equipment pick up anything. I mean, we picked up the guys in playing all over the place, and we picked up some guys later on that were in a firefight somewhere. We could hear them. So you picked up all kinds of bits and pieces everywhere. And you put all that together and say, oh, yeah, it looks like we're going to get into something over there. We're not sure what that is yet, but something's happened.
Hmm. When do you come back from this particular Westpac cruise, come back to the States?
We come back in 63, mid-year, probably almost to the September time frame.
Okay.
63. Maybe a little later on. Remember exactly. It was almost, we got over there around Christmas time in 62, 63, so we wouldn't have been back till almost Christmas time or November of 63.
Back, meaning back to Southeast Asia?
Well, yeah, back to the U.S.
Oh, back to the U.S.
Sometime in the late 63s and early 64, we the timing is difficult to remember.
Sure. So you come back to the States, come back to the West Coast, I guess San Diego.
Yep.
Where you'd be coming into. What would take place once you came back into port?
Well, the first thing, when we came back, because we rode out a couple of typhoons in the South China Sea, we had some damage, and they wanted to add some new electronic equipment. So we went to Long Beach in the yard for a month or two, and then we went back to San Diego. And we put on some different kinds of electronic equipment. Mostly it was jamming equipment, so that you could jam fire control radars, brake lock, what they call it.
Yeah.
Fire control radar locks on, and you can, this new equipment was supposed to be able to break the lock so that fire a missile like that. We won't talk about whether it worked or didn't work, but anyway, that's, once we did that, we went to San Diego. And once you got back to the U.S., you heard a whole lot more about what was going on in Vietnam than you did when you were over there.
Give me an example of that.
Because everybody was rioting and screaming and hollering and marching and all sorts of stuff and talking about it, so you really didn't hear as much over there as you did when you got back.
Yeah. What are your thoughts on that? I mean, this is something that it's a pretty new conflict. The U.S. is really just kind of dipping its toe into it at this point. You mentioned in the last session, you know, it was back then in the military, your job was not to question, to wonder, to, you know, it was to do what you were ordered to do. I mean, that's the role of being in the military. You get back in the States and you see a very different kind of approach to this. What did you think about the protests? What did you think about those who were opposed to what was going on over there?
Well, my thoughts were you shouldn't blame the soldiers, the sailors, the Air Force personnel. They're just doing what they were asked to do. The people that made the decisions were a lot higher up than those of us that were in the military serving. We were there because we wanted to be there. Now, I know that later on, during the war, there were a lot of people that were drafted that didn't want to go over there, and that was a different issue. But I didn't feel right that people were protesting and treating the veterans like they were trash. I felt that was totally wrong. You should always support your military. They're there to protect you and guard you. And whatever reason they're there, they don't have control over that. They're there because they're there to serve. And they're there to protect the public and the homeland. So, like I said, when I got out, I went to college. And when I was in college, everybody we hung around with, except for one or two, were all ex-military. We didn't want to be in part of any riots or any of that stuff. So we kept pretty much to ourselves and pretty quiet.
Yeah.
And a lot of times guys wouldn't even tell anybody they were in the military. You could tell just by looking at them and talking with them whether they're in the military or not versus somebody that's never in the military that was just in college.
Mm-hmm.
It was a different look and attitude about it.
You mentioned something in passing a little bit ago when you were talking about the Anderson sailing through a couple of typhoons. Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
Well, we were, it's South China Sea, it's a pretty rough place. And if you get these typhoons, what happens is you just kind of, you got a storm coming up and you're out to sea, so you get to ride those babies out. And when we first talked, I mentioned the first time I went to sea that I was really seasick and wound up going to bed and getting up the day or so later. I never got sick again. When we were in these storms, we were taking green water, they call it, over the bridge.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's over the top of the ship. And I never got sick. And those of us that didn't get sick wound up standing watch as often and as long as we could before we needed to rest, so that those that did get sick wouldn't have to stand watches. I do know that a couple of times the Combat Information Center, where the radar and the UCM and the sonar was located, was directly behind the bridge, and we had an enclosed bridge, so you didn't have water coming in. I know a couple of times I took break and I said, I'm going to go on the bridge and just look out there and see what's going on. We were on plane guard duty that's behind the aircraft carrier in one of these storms. And I remember walking out there and the captain was out there and he looked at me and nodded. And I said, Captain, is it all right if I watch for a little while? He said, of course, come on out. So I looked out there and sure enough, there's the aircraft carrier. And so now you think about the size of an aircraft carrier. You think about the size of the destroyer and the water coming over the top of our ship. And you look ahead and you see the aircraft carrier going nose down, and you see the propellers of the aircraft carrier coming out of the water.
Woo!
And you watch them spin, and you say, this is a pretty big storm. So those are kind of what you see now. Fortunately for us, Captain Kidd was a really good ship handler. He kept us going just perfect. So we did, we're rocking and rolling, bouncing up and down, and having a big time. But he maintained a station behind the carrier. He made sure that all of us were safe, and he was always a good ship handler.
Hmm. That must have been quite a sight to see that.
Yeah, it was. I mean, it was amazing.
Yeah. You come back in, I guess, late 63. Do you still have one more Westpac cruise in you?
No, I'm going to get out in the mid-64 to the September-October time frame before I get out. So the ship goes back over in late 64, and I'm already out.
Okay, and what brought that about? Why are you off the ship at this point?
I had my 4 years in.
Yeah.
And I didn't want to re-enlist. Re-enlistment's always an option, but I decided that I wanted to go back to college. I wanted to get an education. So I decided that I'd prefer not to re-enlist.
Mm-hmm. So you're out, I guess, then, like you said, in the middle of 64. where did you go to college?
Well, I started at, I met my wife and we got married after I got out. And I went to college in Chaffey College in California. And then we moved back to Tennessee where she was from. And I finished up at the University of Memphis.
Okay. And what did you choose to study there?
I studied to be an architect for 2 years and found out that, you know, I was looking for work and going to school and working at the same time. I found out that you couldn't make a lot of money unless you owned your own deal, and it was pretty tough. Holiday Inn in Memphis had offered to hire me to design the interiors of their bars. And it was like $85 a week or something like that to do that. And I said, I don't know if I want to do that. So I went and talked with one of the counselors at the college, and he said, you ought to get involved in this computer stuff. So we got a computer science, computer courses here. You ought to take a look at that. So that's what I did. I wound up going in all the computer classes, and I wound up with a degree in computer science and was hired by Holiday Inn when I got out to not even finish the school while I was still in, to help them because I had learned a bunch of programming languages, and I went over there and worked for them, worked on their accounts payable, accounts receivable systems. And then after that, I did some independent consulting and was hired by EDS, which was Ross Perot's company, and I worked for there for 27 years.
Interesting. Got in on the ground floor of some of this stuff.
Yep. Yeah. It was a great ride. Working for Ross Perot was just like being in the military. The guy was brilliant, if you think about it. When he started his company, he hired mostly, not mostly, when he started his company, he had a few friends that he knew from the University of Texas, so he had, and the Naval Academy. So he brought all these guys on. And when he wanted to fill up the ranks, he hired a lot of ex-military. Because he said, they know how to take orders. They understand the chain of command. They don't have to be taught. They understand if someone's in charge, they're in charge, and you should follow and do what you need to do to support them. So I think it was just a brilliant stroke on his part. Yeah. But it was a great ride. I enjoyed my 27 years there thoroughly.
Let me take you back to Memphis. You spoke briefly on, the protests in general in the U.S. and kind of the approach and the way you saw it through your eyes. But can you take me through what it was like to be on the campus at Memphis during the mid-1960s, working on a degree while the Vietnam War is going, full bore at this time? What was it like to be there?
There's a lot of people that were against the war. You didn't get the protest there like you did in the other colleges. Mm-hmm. Memphis, Tennessee in the South was a lot more conservative than some of the more liberal colleges in the northern areas. So you didn't get as much of that as you would other places. But you still got a lot of chatter from people, professors and teachers and students as well, about they were against the war, they were against this, they were against that. And and occasionally you hear somebody say, the soldiers are over there killing babies, and you'd look at them and say, no, I don't think that's true. And they'd look at you and say, well, how do you know? And so unless you want to tell them you were over there, you just kind of say, I just don't believe they'd be doing that. Mm-hmm. And a couple of my really good friends were deep in the depths of Vietnam, and they would, we'd all say, we just got to be quiet about all that and not get involved because we'll wind up getting in a big fight, and we don't want to do that.
Certainly.
So everybody kept pretty quiet. I mean, you can talk to guys today that were, and I'm sure you have, through your efforts there at the Texas Tech, and they'll all tell you the same thing. You just keep kind of quiet about it. You don't talk about it too much because you don't want to get in a big fight.
Yeah. Did you keep up with the war at all?
Oh yeah, I wore a bracelet of, and I've got it somewhere, of one of the POWs. Mm-hmm. until he got released and came home.
Yeah.
And I had friends that I met that were coming back, so I kept up with it for them. I had one of the guys I play golf with every day, every week is Marine, ex-Marine, and he was over there in 67, 68. We talk a little about it. We don't talk too much about it.
What was your impression at the time of what was going on over there, the way the war was being fought?
My impression was that in the beginning we were doing pretty good, and in the end we weren't doing too good. My impression was that we were doing a holding pattern kind of thing where we're just making sure stuff didn't get too crazy over there.
Mm-hmm.
And my thoughts were, if you're going to fight a war, you need to fight a war to win, not go over and just kind of hold around and hopefully nothing bad happens.
Yeah.
So I didn't think we were there to, at the end, I didn't think there was enough emphasis for winning. My thoughts were, we could have won a long time ago and not lost as many people. But if you refuse to bomb certain areas and eliminate certain adversaries that are coming from different directions, then if you refuse to eliminate that, you're not going to win.
Mm-hmm.
So my thoughts, and many of my friends, and a lot of them will say the same thing, is we should have been doing a whole lot more, a whole lot sooner.
Well, that takes us to the end of the war. What did you think about the U.S. withdrawal there in 73, and then later the collapse of Saigon in April of 75?
I thought the same thing. I said, here we go. We're over there to support these people, and now we're bailing out on them. And I don't think that's the right thing to do, because bad things are going to happen. We knew from the pictures of the war and from friends that were over there that the Vietnamese and Viet Cong and the communist Chinese were going to go in there and just kill everybody that was part of the effort to keep them from getting in there, and they were going to turn the country into another communist country, a socialist country. So we knew teachers, educators, politicians, anybody with any intelligence could wind up getting killed. And we said, you know, that's a terrible thing to say, but that's we shouldn't have bailed out on our friends. If we were going to be there to fight and win, we should have been there to fight and win, not leave when bad things happen. So I kind of think that's what a lot of us felt.
You mentioned in a couple different ways, you were talking about Vietnam veterans, the way they were received upon returning to the U.S., and kind of the way y'all approached the war similarly, by not talking about it, just kind of avoiding the whole thing. But it leads me into another area here, and it has to do with the perception of the Vietnam veteran over the years. What do you think about this perception? And I say perception, I should say perceptions plural, because the view in American society of the Vietnam veteran has changed in a number of ways over the years. What is your opinion on the way Vietnam vets have been viewed throughout the years?
I think they've been viewed incorrectly. I know a lot of people thought they were over there druggies and were doing whatever and just over there to kill people. That's not. I don't know anybody that was that way. And I know a lot of guys. I'm in some of the associations, and I know a lot of guys, and I don't know anybody that was over there doing those kinds of things. Now, it seems like the newspapers and certain medias sensationalize things that they find that is on the outside of what's really going on.
Mm-hmm.
So what you find is you find a couple of different things happening, or a couple people that are doing things they shouldn't be doing as far as drugs and so forth. And some of the movies are highlighting that, and people saying, well, look, these guys are all crazy and druggies. And And that's just not true. I don't know anybody that was doing any of that. I'm sure some did, but they don't talk about it. But I personally don't know anybody that was into that stuff. Yeah, everybody was drinking beer or doing those sorts of things. That's just kind of part of it. Some didn't, of course, absolutely didn't want to drink. But there were, most everybody would drink a beer once in a while and go out and have some fun with it when they were on shore leave or wherever they were. But I don't know anybody that would say that the picture that was painted of the Vietnam veteran was right. There's a lot of good guys that got killed over there. There's a lot of good guys that came back that didn't want to talk about it. And there's a lot of, I consider the media painting pictures that were not 100% correct.
Hmm.
You know, you're always going to have a fringe element that does things that shouldn't be done, and they wind up in the news. But you don't see the majority of the people that really were doing the right thing. You don't see a lot of accolades about how they did and what they did and how they honored themselves and honored their country and honored their units. You don't see any of that. All you see is, well, these guys, they did this, this, and this, therefore, you know, these guys are all terrible over there. It's kind of like, don't like to get into politics, but it's kind of like politics today. It's all naked. Remember, you know, it's every time you turn the TV on, somebody's done something that somebody doesn't like, and so these guys are going to report negative stuff as opposed to good things that may have happened. So, you know, it's just it's difficult to bridge from the bad that you hear to the good because you hear too much bad.
Yeah. You know, Richard, you mentioned movies a little bit ago. Are there any movies about the Vietnam War that you watch that you like, dislike, or books or anything like that?
I try not to watch any Vietnam movies.
Why is that?
I don't like to see that because it reminds me of friends of mine that died over there. And I'll watch, you know, some of the crazy stuff like, I think I did watch Platoon when it came out. But I don't remember any others that I watched. I watched some of the World War II movies. I like to watch a lot of the Navy movies, the historical movies and stuff
sure.
like that, but I don't kind of watch any of the others. I don't watch any of the movies that are coming out about Iraq or Iran or any of those places either. I just don't watch those anymore because I don't like watching guys getting killed.
Mm-hmm. Well, I just really have like one last question for you, Richard, and it's a pretty broad one. So feel free to address it and answer it however you see fit. But one of the things that we have encountered over the generations regarding the Vietnam War is, what did we learn? You know, these were the lessons of the Vietnam War. No, this was the lesson of the Vietnam War. And we're having, still all these years later, some difficulty really wrapping our heads as a country around this Vietnam War experience. You were in that part of the world. You lived through this. You were in Southeast Asia, and then you saw it in the United States as a college student and even later. So let me ask you, what do you think is the legacy of the Vietnam War? What does the Vietnam War mean to you?
Well, I think one, I'm not sure we should have been there. Number two, if we're going to be there, then we should be there to win. And number three, you should honor those that are supporting the country, whether it's in Vietnam or any other place. And I think, to me, those are the key things. You shouldn't go into a war if you don't belong there. And in many cases, I kind of question what we're doing in some areas and why we're doing it. But once you make the decision that we're going to do that, then everybody needs to be on board. We shouldn't be having people taking pot shots at military, or anyone else once the decision is made to go forward. And I've noticed that our guys that are over in the Middle East now are being treated that way. They're being treated with honor and respect for the service that they're providing, as opposed to what happened to some of the Vietnam vets. Their Vietnam vets aren't any different than the guys that are over in the Middle East right now. They're guys that were some drafted in Vietnam, some joined, but they were serving their country and doing what the country asked them to do. And so they shouldn't be, they should be honored for that and respected for that. And I think that's one of the things I wish that people would learn, is that don't blame the individual or have a bad feeling about an individual that's serving this country or she's serving her country, because you should always honor them.
Richard, is there anything else you would like to add to the interview before we bring it to a close?
No, one thing, when I was talking about the schooling, I was at the, it's a, this place that started, it's called State Technical Institute in Memphis, too.
Okay.
And it's a really good school. I would highly recommend anybody going to that school to get a good education and start. They're a great place. But I don't know of anything else that I could add. I think... first and foremost, we need to honor our leaders in the country and try to let them do the work that they should do. Honor our military personnel. And remember, they're there to support our government, and they're there to keep us safe. We shouldn't be negative about what they do and how they do it. There's always going to be a fringe element that does crazy stuff, but the majority of the guys and gals in the military are just outstanding.
Very well put. All right, we will end the interview then.
Okay, great.